So this is the second day. So we're saying this is the second day of our three-day retreat, silent retreat on the Buddha's teaching, be an island unto oneself, a refuge on oneself, the unshakable refuge. And we will continue this morning with looking at the Buddha's teachings on this island and begin to work our way into refuge, and then tomorrow dealing primarily with the various levels of refuge. As was said in the talk at the beginning of today, be an island unto oneself. Oneself is not a place. It's more like a pronoun. It kind of describes something that belongs to one. And the teachings on be an island unto oneself, a refuge unto oneself, make the Dharma your only refuge, is an antidote to our usual way of conducting business. Usually we take, traditionally we take refuge in the world of self and ego, and our concern is with the drama that ego creates as it tries to make sense of and get its way in the dualistic world of its own creation. The Dharma offers us something very different. It is very simple. It is very clear and very obvious. But we have so much trouble with it. because it just comes at things from a totally different view, which is not the view where ego and self is the prime mover. And where the world of dualism, the world of separation and disconnection and opposites, it is seen, but it is not validated by a chronic attaching and averting to the phenomena that the ego perceives. So again, why we need to take refuge is, again, because it is not readily apparent to us. It is not historically what we're conditioned to. So we need to make a break. And the teaching that the Buddha is giving us is showing us how to do that. And many of us may struggle with this for years. But traditionally in Buddhism, it is said, make this break in the beginning. Then everything will go smooth. But if you don't make this break in the beginning, then it's a struggle. Seeming gains that one makes in a retreat or through some sort of breakthrough just get washed away as we continue to lead our egocentric, deluded, attached, averting life. So hopefully, this is a short retreat, a three-day retreat, but hopefully we'll get enough nourishment and practice and insight, and that this time we can make that shift. So, this is another one. This is from the, yesterday we read from the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. This is the Atadipa Sutra, which is the Island in Oneself Sutra. It's very short. And the Buddha says, it's variation, it says, but it's a little different. Monks, be islands unto yourselves, be your own refuge, having no other. Let the Dharma be an island and a refuge to you, having no others. And then he said, which is pretty much what we discussed yesterday, then he says, those who are islands unto themselves should investigate to the very heart of things. And the question, he says, to be investigated is, what is the source of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair? How do they arise? What is their origin? You want me to say it in Gaelic?
No.
Okay.
What's the weather?
What's the weather?
Yeah. It's be an island of yourself. No weather. Oh, no weather.
No weather.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's fine. You had me going there for a minute.
Me too.
Okay. Do I need to repeat that question, Alex, or should we let that one go? Yeah. So again, here he's saying, those who are islands unto themselves should investigate to the heart of things. And we know in the Buddhist meditative tradition, you know, mindfulness, samadhi, samatha, and then Vipassana, insight. Deep, Thich Nhat Hanh calls it mindfulness stopping, deep looking. So here he's saying, in the other one yesterday, we talked a lot about mindfulness, right? Mindfulness of in the realm of form, mindfulness in the realm of feeling sensation, mindfulness in the realm of mind and thought, perceptions, and mindfulness in terms of the objects, the four foundations of mindfulness is set forth in the teachings of the Buddha on mindfulness, anapanasati, etc. In this one, he goes about it a little different. Now he's saying, investigate, look deeply. And again, this is at the heart of really what Buddhism is about. The heart of the Buddha's teaching himself, because this is exactly what he did. Right. His discovery of his own true nature, Buddha nature. His discovery of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence, right? All came about because he looked deeply into his own experience, into his own mind, and he was interested in causation. Right? It is said in relationship to the Four Noble Truths that if you understand truly the second one, you have realized the third. Right? If you truly understand the cause of suffering, you understand the liberation and cessation of suffering. Right? It is that simple. Right? If you understand that your toe is hurting because there's a thorn in it, right? Well, then you know what to do to stop it from hurting, don't you? You just pull out the thorn. Right? First noble truth, my toe hurts. Right? Second noble truth, I look deeply into what's causing it to hurt, and I see a thorn. Step three, obvious, is what? Pull it out. Right? Again, please read less and look more deeply into your own suffering. And do what the Buddha instructs us to do. Go to the very heart of it. And he gives us the question: what is the source of my sorrow, the source of my grief, the source of my pain, the source of my despair? And we could go on. It's, you know, I mean, Buddhism had lists, you know, and sometimes we see two things or four things or five things, but it's really, you know, what is the source of my anger? What is the source of my fear? What is the source of my impatience? What is the source of my jealousy? You know what I mean? It's right? It just goes on. These are called afflictive emotions. What is the source of my affliction emotions? How did they arise? What caused them to arise in me? What is their origin? Where did they come from? Right? You know, just walking around. Toe didn't hurt. Feeling quite good. And all of a sudden my toe hurts. Ouch! Pain, suffering. So please look deeply. Here, monks, the uninstructed worldling, interesting phrase, the uninstructed worldling, I guess that's us, the Thakkara thinks to himself, herself, change occurs in my body and it becomes different. On account of this change and this difference, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise. Similarly, with feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, these are the five skandhas. Again, he's saying, if we attend in mindfulness, in concentration, and look deeply, we will see that change is constantly occurring. And so much of what disturbs us and causes our mental, emotional afflictions to arise is simply things are changing. That's all that's going on. Feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. That's all that's going on. Things are changing. But the ego does what? Because of its delusion and its attachments and its aversions, it creates a story in which we posit a me and a you and us and a them. And that whole story is a projection of our delusive thinking. It is not in the object itself, is it? The story is coming from us. And we believe our own stories. So the Buddha says, the islands unto yourself, your own refuge, having no other. Look deeply, investigate to the heart. Somebody was saying yesterday, maybe I'm not going deep enough. Maybe I'm just noting thoughts, feelings, perceptions. How do I deepen it? Go to the heart of things. How do you get to the heart of things? You look. What is the origin of? Where did it begin? What's causing it to arise within me? when you're an island unto yourself, you know, the universe of one's own thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sensations, this is the universe we investigate. This is the universe the Buddha investigated. And when he truly understood at the heart of things who and what he was, the cause of his own suffering and the cause of his own liberation, he understood the minds of everyone. The wisdom of his own experience and the wisdom of his own true nature and his wisdom in understanding things as they really are allowed him to understand everything that was presented to him. Again, that doesn't mean he could fix every plumbing problem. It doesn't mean he was a master auto mechanic. Right? It didn't mean that he would master computers. But in terms of human beings and how they operate and their minds and what creates happiness and what creates suffering, in that he was an expert. Because he looked deeply. That is why it is said in our tradition, all of us have this capacity to awake. All of us have the capacity to attain Buddhahood. All of us includes everyone in this room. If anyone's over there excluding yourself. Just want you to know the Buddha did not leave you out. But we have to do what he says. And so this worldling, by seeing the body's impermanence, its changeability, its waning, its ceasing, says to him or herself, formerly as now, all bodies were impermanent and unsatisfactory and subject to change. As I look through my life, as in the past, and as I look at my moment-to-moment situation now, I see all bodies, everything, are impermanent, and because they're impermanent, are inherently unsatisfactory. Again, Buddhism, what they're saying here, this dukkha, this unsatisfactory, this impermanence, unsatisfactory, they're unsatisfactory because why? Because we can't get anything from them on any kind of consistent basis. Because they're always changing, we perceive the change as suffering. Right? What from the enlightened mind, it's just seen as change, we see it as unsatisfactory because of our misperception, because of our attachment, because our wanting things to not change. Right? That's why the master says, when it's hot, I sweat. When it's cold, I shiver. That's profound. He doesn't say, when it's hot, I'm miserable. And when it's cold, I'm delighted. Things are just the way they are. I don't make a big deal about it. Right? Things are changing. Sometimes I'll be hot, sometimes I'm cold. Sometimes I'm comfortable, sometimes I'm uncomfortable. Right? Sometimes the body is pain-free, sometimes it's full of pain. Big deal. Right? One day it'll all be over. You won't have a body anymore. Right? Look around you. Look around your life. There are lots of people who don't have these issues at all anymore. We used to get very bent out of shape around this kind of stuff. No, they don't have any issues related to their body or their drama of their life. Right? But in Buddhism, we don't, you know, we don't yearn for death so we can be at peace. Right? Some people yearn for death, right? Some people say, I want to die. Do you know that? Some people actually take their life because they want to be at peace. And they don't know how to do it in their life, while alive. We don't want to be like that. Buddhism teaches us how to be at peace while we're alive. Formerly as now, all bodies were impermanent, satisfactory, and subject to change. Thus, seeing this as it really is, with perfect insight, he or she abandons all sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I like this next line. He or she is not worried at their abandonment. Right? Some people are worried about letting go. What's going to happen if I stop being attached? You know, what would life be like without drama? Right? Sort of like that. You know, especially people who live in the drama. What would life be like without the drama? There's a fear in that. And they sense an emptiness in that. We know people in their deeper meditation often get to a point where they feel things are beginning to become a little unglued. They get to a place in their meditation where their normal touchstones are no longer so close and present. They often begin to touch the experience of non-self, and they get scared. They get scared. But a good practitioner is not worried at their abandonment. Because the Buddha and the Masters have shown us the way. They have shown us and taught us that it is ego and self-identity and attachment, delusion, etc., is the cause of our suffering, is the root of it, right? We should be happy. We should be delighted. If the experience of non-attachment, letting go, seeing deeply, non-self, begins to dawn in our awareness, right? This is the beginning of liberation. And it can be a profound meditative experience, but also we have the opportunity all the time, let go. Every time you suffer, every time you have any kind of emotional intensity, you're holding on. You're holding on, simple as that. Just let go. Angry, sad, afraid. You're holding on to something. Dharma says let go. And it says let go. And you'll be happy. And you'll be free. And you'll be calm. And you'll be peaceful. Right? There's not a person in this room that hasn't heard that teaching or read that teaching 10,000 times. And yet we go through our day and all we do is grasp and avert, cling and push away and make a big deal about. He or she is not worried at their abandonment, but unworried lives at ease. Very common phrase for the Buddhist follower, a true follower. Ease. Lives with the mind and body at ease. Equanimity. And thus, living at ease is said to be assuredly delivered. This must be some phrase that has to do with delivered from suffering, delivered from ignorance. Now here's another one. I just wanted to show you how the Buddha handles things. This is from the Kunda Sutta. Kunda Sutta is also called the Sariputta's. Remember Sariputra? Oh, Sariputra. Form is none, right? Sariputra. One of these two monks up there is Sariputra. Sariputra is one of the great elders of the Buddha's Sangha. He was an elder of the Sangha. The Buddha was dwelling at Saravasti, at Anathapandika's park. And those of us who went on pilgrimage several years ago, we were there. Remember, Alex? We were there in Saravasti, in Anathapandika. Angie was there. Ruth was there. Who else was there? Anybody else there? Sam and Mara were there. That's right. So, the Buddha was there. And actually, I remember there was a building or something they said which was Sariputra's hut or something. So at that time, the Venerable Sariputra was at Nalaka village in the Magadha country and was sick, suffering gravely ill. The novice Kunda was his attendant. And the Venerable Sariputra passed away finally through that illness. Then the novice Kunda took the alms bowl and robes of the Venerable Sariputra and went to Saravasti to the Jeta Grove, Anathapandika's park. Anathapandika was that physician, again, a famous lay supporter of the Buddha. There he betook himself to the Venerable Ananda. We know Ananda. Again, kind of attendant to attendant, right? And having saluted him, seated himself at the side. Thus seated, he spoke to the Venerable Ananda, saying, "Venerable Sir, the Venerable Sariputra has had his final passing away. These are his bowl and robes." And so Ananda says, "On this matter, Kunda, we ought to go see the Buddha, the Blessed One. Let us go, friend Kunda, and meet the Master. Having met him, we shall acquaint the Blessed One with this fact, the fact that his disciple Sariputra has passed on." And Kunda says, "Yes." So they went to the Buddha, and having arrived there, they saluted him. Well, it means they bowed to him, maybe circumambulated. They seated themselves to one side. Then the Venerable Ananda addressed the Blessed One. "O Lord, the novice Kunda has told me this. The Venerable Sariputra has had his final passing away. These are his bowl and robes." And then Ananda continues, and it's almost like the same lines we've heard him say yesterday. "Then, O Lord, my own body became weak as a creeper. Everything around became dim, and things were no longer clear to me. When I heard about this final passing away of the Venerable Sariputra." And then I want you to pay close attention to how the Buddha handles his disciple Ananda. So the Buddha, so Ananda saying, "When I heard this news, I was just overwhelmed." Right? Overwhelmed. And so the Buddha says to Ananda, how is this, Ananda? When Sariputra had his final passing away, did he take from you your portion of virtue, your portion of concentration, your portion of knowledge, insight, understanding? Did he take away from you your vision of deliverance? So the Buddha is like a good teacher. He asks questions, right? Trying to get this guy to think. Right? And so Ananda says, no, O Lord. When the Venerable Sariputra had his final passing away, he did not take away my portion of virtue, my portion of concentration, my portion of wisdom, my portion of freedom, or my portion of the knowledge and vision of deliverance. So, do you understand? The Buddha is saying, all these qualities that you have cultivated, right? Mindfulness, concentration, understanding, peace of mind, right? You know, I mean, everything that is meaningful to you, your compassion, your loving, you know what I mean? Has any of this been taken away from you, right? And so, and Ananda says, no, none of that's been taken away. So, Kunda says, Ananda says, not so. He didn't, none of this. But, O Lord, you know that but. This is a but we all know well. All right, now comes the justification, rationalization for continuing even though we know better. remember the know better guy? Yeah, so you're not alone. This is a long tradition of... But, O Lord, the Venerable Sariputra has been to me a mentor, a teacher, an instructor, one who rouses, inspires, and gladdens, untiring in his preaching of the Dharma, a helper of his fellow monks. And we remember how vitalizing, enjoyable, and helpful his Dharma instructions were. Very beautiful, right? So this is the person. He's saying, but you know, he was such a good guy. You know? We so much liked having him around. You know, he was so helpful. He was so, you know what I'm saying? It's like he kind of knows what the Buddha is trying to get at, but he pushes back a little bit, right? But he was a good friend of mine. We were close. I loved him. You know, I liked having him in my life, right? So let's see what the Buddha does with that. Ananda, have I not taught you aforetime that is the nature of all things near and dear to us, that we must suffer separation from them and be severed from them? Of that which is born, come to being, put together, and so is subject to dissolution, how should it be said that it should not depart? That indeed is not possible. It is, Ananda, as though from a mighty hardwood tree a large branch should break off. So has Sariputra now had his final passing away from this great and sound community of bhikkhus, monks. Indeed, Ananda, of that which is born, come to being, put together, and so is subject to dissolution, how should it not be said that it shouldn't depart? This indeed, again, is not possible. Therefore, Ananda, be an island unto yourself, a refuge unto yourself, seeking no external refuge, with the Dharma as your island, the Dharma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. So that is another place where the Buddha sort of gave that same phraseology, same teaching. We wonder why, with all our reading, studying, practicing of Dharma, it has not permeated us. Because I think for many of us, our Dharma, our refuge in Dharma, is over here. Like in its own compartment. Right? And when we want it, we open it up and we take it out. It's not here. That's the problem. It's still something we have to access. We have to go to. It's not something here. It's not living. We're not living the Dharma. And so we see in this wonderful, anecdote here, that's what Ananda has done, and the Buddha's trying to help him, right? Because obviously, has Ananda heard the Buddha's teaching over and over and over again? He was his attendant, right? And we know teaching on everything is subject to change, everything, right? I mean, this is like every day. I mean, the Buddha must have said this every day, right? And yet, here in this moment, this poignant moment of the loss of his dear mentor, right? Ananda goes, yes, but, right? And the Buddha very wisely goes, there's no buts. And that's, I think, something also that we do. We practice Dharma, but we want to pass, or we want the exception, right? I know everybody ages and gets old, but why me? I understand that. Oh, yes, I understand that, but when I look in the mirror, it's like, I don't like it. You know what I mean? It's like that, right? I know everybody gets sick and is subject to disease, but why my son or daughter? I know everybody dies at some point, but that seems so unfair that this person should die at this age, right? It's just like Ananda with the Buddha. I know everyone suffers. I know this world is impermanent. I know things change. But it shouldn't have happened to me. I mean, we could go on and on with examples, but do you know what I mean? It's like we resist the embrace, the full embrace of Dharma, which means the true meaning of the teachings and the practices. It's very subtle, but it's kind of gross too. Meaning, it's like we just don't bring it in. We don't live it. We don't live from it. We don't make it our refuge. And again, I'm not talking an article of faith. an article of belief, you know. I'm saying something that's living, and something that can readily be experienced, the truth of. Because the Buddha says here, he says, you know, he says, don't read, you know, in that other one. He says, you know, don't read my holy book. Right, does he? He says, you know, look at your own suffering. Right? Go to the heart of it. Seek its origin. I mean, those are his instructions. He's pointing the way for us. And it's not in words. It's in direct experience. So this is very important. I mean, this is Buddhism unadorned. Very direct. That which is born, come into being, put together, is subject to dissolution, and therefore will depart. Do branches break off from a tree, the Buddha says, right? No. Branches break off from a tree. Sariputra was a great branch of the Buddha Sangha. But the Buddha says branches break off, don't they? That's just the way it is. You know, we have a community here of 36 people today. All of us are subject to change. All of us will die. All of us will be sick. All of us will age. Right? 20, 30 years ago from now, who knows if any one of us will be here. Hopefully, these kinds of teachings will continue on. Somebody will be presenting them. So the Buddha Dharma will continue in the human realm. But we're just passing through, aren't we? And while when we hear news of somebody we care about passing, and we feel an initial sadness, grief. It is tempered, it is softened by our understanding that this is normal. Right? This is not unbelievable. We say, "This is can you believe what happened?" This is nothing is unbelievable. Right. We just don't believe it's going to happen to us or those we love or care about. So, be an island unto yourself. So let me say a few things about refuge, because that was the other piece. Any final questions in terms of our refuge? I mean, our island unto oneself. Anything not clear about what the Buddha's up to and what his teachings are and how to practice it and yes.
It seems to me that because we're in this human form, when our toe hurts, we say, ouch, and when someone leaves, we cry.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha didn't give Ananda any sympathy at all. So are we allowed a little lead time there to kind of cry and then temper it? You know, yeah. It seems to me I would have...
Why are you afraid to temper it right away?
I don't want to judge the crying.
You're not to judge the crying. I'm just saying, why... the question is, you know... yeah, the question is, can't we... the Buddha, you know, he kind of came right in with teaching to Ananda. Can't we, you know, can't we have some time to cry and grieve a dear friend? And again... as I just said, I think it's a tempering. It's a, you know. You know, they're, let's say, at a loss, right? There's a natural grief. It just happens. It's not premeditated. It just happens, right? One feels it. If there is a close connection, right? But that feeling by itself will dissipate. Okay. It is usually maintained on an extended basis by our continued revisiting of it. Okay. And so therefore it is not that initial human emotional response. Because I actually think, I think the Buddha actually says something to that effect with Sariputra. He says, it is the nature of all things near and dear to us. So I think he's acknowledging that Sariputra was somebody that was near and dear to us. That we must suffer separation. So he's implying, yes, you know, we will experience a suffering of separation. That is a suffering. And he acknowledges that, of that. But then he goes on to say, you know, his teaching. So again, I think what we're talking about here is that there is, being human beings, we do feel, such as when we feel the thorn, we go, ouch, and it hurts. But would you leave it in at that point? The ouch and the pain is the acknowledgement of the hurt. And recently there are some people in the Sangha who have had some dear friends of theirs very close die very unexpectedly. And the people who died were fairly young and also very well connected within the community. Lots of friends and people cared about them. So lots of grief, lots of anger, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what these practitioners said to me was they were surprised that even though, of course, this was dear and dear friends, yet they didn't kind of go down that extended emotional role and actually were amazed at their capacity to be there for others. You know, to be there for the grieving family, to be support, to be helpful, to be counseling, you know. In this anecdote, you can see, right? You know, if Ananda was running the community, could have been, you know, histrionics for days. Old Ananda, sweetheart that he was, you know, just missing Sariputra and going on and on about him. And, you know what I'm saying? And the Buddha said, just kind of, he was there for Ananda. And again, remember, before he gave the teaching, he asked the questions. You know, what have you lost? Have you lost your goodness? Have you lost your, you know, have you lost all the things that are really, you know, that are on your island? That's what he said. You know, all those qualities that are on your island that allow you to, you know, to really be there for others, right? Have you lost any of that? And Ananda said, no, everything that's really essential, I still have, but I've lost Sariputra. And the Buddha says, but you should have known all along that at some point you would lose Sariputra, right? I mean, that's just the way it is in Ananda, right? It's like, you know, that anecdote, you know, with the broken cup, you know what I mean? The monk gets the brand new cup, and the first thing he does, he visualizes it dropped on the floor and cracked in a million pieces. Right? He's already acknowledged that it is impermanent, and at some point he will lose it. Right? And then he continues from then, you know, to use it. But he knows at some point it's going to break, it's going to chip. Right? So it's like that. You know, the Buddha said, you know, and he wasn't being hard, you know what I mean? He was saying, because we know the Buddha loved Sariputta, they had a very close relationship. But the Buddha said, you know, I always knew that at some point the branch would break from the tree. It's just the nature of things. So again, when Dharma is in here, in our hearts, in our minds, and not in a little cabinet next to us. It's a big difference. We don't have to pull it out. You know, what does the Buddha say about death? You know, I gotta figure it out. Somebody just passed. That's kind of how we do it. Right? It's like we, you know, get out our Dharma Rolodex or something. Let me Google this, you know. what does the Buddha say about? But by the time we've done it, it's we're already half out the door, you know what I mean? Gone. So the implication here is, you know, look at the people sitting to your right, look at the people sitting to the left, you know what I mean? Look at your significant others, look at your children, your parents, your friends, look at them all, and look at them and know that they will die, and they will age, and they will be sick. Every one of them. And when you look at yourself in the mirror and the same thing. And that's not morbid, that's not negative, that's just real, and it allows us to live our life much more freely, with much greater acceptance, and allows us to be there for others. Any other questions about islands and the Buddha's teaching? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. See you.
Forgiving them?
The people who might have wronged you, or...
Forgiving myself.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know any better, they did the best they could. Is that in line with, you know,
Yeah. The question is specifically when you have thoughts that arise that come from experiences from the past, in which incidences or experience with other people arise that were harmful or negative. She's saying what I usually do is forgive them. Forgive them?
Yes.
Or understand them and forgive myself. Again, forgiveness is interesting. We won't go into it. But in Buddhism, traditionally, it is understanding causes and conditions, which is sort of the same thing. Right? To say they didn't know better is to understand that the causes and conditions that had created them, right, and from which they were living from, they were totally ensnared in, right? And therefore they only acted from their own conditioning, right? And so in a sense, there's no, like, person to blame. It's really the causes and conditions to understand that created it. It's sort of like, I think it was Gandhi or somebody said, you know, don't hate the sinner, hate the sin. You know, if you're going to hate something, hate hatred, or hate ignorance, or, you know, that's the cause. It's like the you know, that's what's you know, that's the puppeteer. Most human beings are like puppets, and it's their conditioning that is just, you know, they do this and that, and they don't know that they're being controlled by their conditions. I mean, as practitioners, we are trying to rise above that, right, and have consciousness so we can see, oh, I can see my conditioning. I can see the causes that have created me, caused me to act in certain ways and react in certain ways and think, you know, and I can see none of it is true. It's all just conditioning. So therefore I can change, I can transform. But most people don't know that, do they? They just continue to bang around totally controlled by their conditioning, their views, right? So understanding, right, and then also compassion for, you know, if you can, for them and yourself, which understands, if you can get beyond what happened and look more deeply, you see they were not happy people, right? They had a deep wounds in themselves, deep sufferings within themselves, that they didn't know, you know, they didn't have the tools to heal and transform their own suffering. So they just continue to inflict it, right, on others. You know, and in your case, you know, it's almost like you just happen to be there, you know. I think that didn't make maybe less painful, right? But to understand, you know, they were just acting out from their own suffering. And again, you know, Lindsay, you're not alone in that. That unfortunately is kind of the one of the major themes of this world. Right. I mean, we cannot help but look around the world and see, you know, on personal levels, on social levels, you know, the pain and suffering that people inflict, right, on their fellow human being, you know, and you know, and all kinds of reasons, right? In the name of religion, in the name of nationalism, in the name of bringing peace, you know, mm-hmm. You know, human beings, right? Unfortunately, we don't keep our suffering just to ourselves. We seem to have this unfortunate need to inflict it on others. And again, you know, it's also good to understand that maybe not to the extent that was done to us, but maybe in much milder ways, perhaps, or maybe some of the same ways, we've done it too in our life, you know, to others. And that's humbling, again, because when one looks, you know, at the suffering that one has afflicted another, one realizes, you know, I didn't know better, right? I thought this was helpful, or I thought this was, you know what I mean, or I thought they deserved it, or, you know what I mean, we were ignorant too. And so that kind of helps us kind of deepen our understanding of this, that this is just the way this world operates. Because, coming back to the theme of our retreat, this world does not operate on dharmic principles. And most human beings are not living a life based on dharma, are they? Right? They are living a life of anti-dharma. You know, they're basing their life on egocentricity, their attachment, aversion, hatred, love. You know what I mean? That's their world. Right? And that's the world. You know, in Buddhism, this world is called the Saha world, the samsara, the Saha world. It is a world of birth and death. It is a world of duality. It is a world of suffering. I'm sorry to say, but in Buddhist cosmology of the different worlds one can be born into, this doesn't rate very high. We didn't get into the Ivy League college on this one.
What? I just want to go back to this real world that you talk about, because we're in here and Sangha and there's like-mindedness and there's a comfort level, but out of the real world out there that you alluded to, we have misconception. Sometimes ignorance, lack of understanding, innocence, whatever you want to term it. And then we transition from, like, maybe where most of the population is, say if we have a bell-shaped curve, and then we get to the other extreme, which is deception. So you go from misconception, where you have a few outliers, and then you have deception, and you have the other outliers. But it seems to me that the way that works is you transition through intention. And what is the intention that you start to pick up when you deal with people, and how do you deal with that in a real way?
That's a question.
Yes.
since I am beholden to repeat it, can you just kind of just give it like the nub of the question?
Another person, when in fact it can be presented in a very different way.
You mean? So I understand the question. You're saying that how do you deal with human beings who are ignorant of their motivation, or all the way up to consciously deceiving, or unconsciously?
Yeah. Misconceive something, because when you explain something to them, they say, oh, aha, I got it. I'm sorry, that will be, filed now, and I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are the people who look you in the eye and say, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, and I never really wanted to do that, and I'm sorry, but their intent is not the same as what they portray it to be.
Mm-hmm.
How do you then address that? Because it's a real problem.
So you're asking me, how do you deal with liars?
How do you...
Hypocrites?
How do you, with skill, deal with intentional deception? When
liars and hypocrites.
We can start with them.
Okay. I just want to... You know, I'm...
I'm fairly concrete. I want to see who are we talking about here? All right. Here we go, and we'll work out from there. Yeah, Alex. I mean, it's so Alex wants to know. You know, there are a lot of people that are kind of misconceive things, misperceive things, and yet they're kind of open. But if you have a dialogue with them, a meaningful dialogue, a rational dialogue, and an empathic dialogue, they are open to seeing things differently, acknowledging something, right? And Alex, he says he likes that. But he says,
I don't like it. I can deal with it.
You can deal with it. That's what I meant. I meant you like it. I mean, in other words, it's something that you're comfortable dealing with. But then Alex said he's run across this type of human animal that may present themselves in one way, and yet it is totally phony. It's false. It's hypocritical. It's deceitful. It's, you know what I mean? It's hard to really know what's going on. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, someone who lies, are they lying because they're very, you know, in a totally manipulative, conscious way going about it, or do they kind of believe their own lies, right? Believe their own deception. You know, it's often hard to sort out, but the bottom line, it still presents itself the same way, right? So you're having a problem acknowledging that there are these kind of people in the world?
No, I acknowledge it.
Okay.
I'm asking you to help me with skillfully dealing with it.
Yeah. Well, again, you've probably heard me say before, and I'll say, I mean, this is the way I understand it, and I'll use the same example you've probably heard me say before. How do you deal with a rattlesnake? Discriminating wisdom allows me to understand the difference between a garter snake, right, and a rattlesnake. Okay. With a garter snake, a garden snake, I can what? Be unguarded, be relaxed, right? Not have to take any defensive measures at all. I can even appreciate. Garden snake is a garden snake because it's a garden snake. Right? It manifests its way as a garden snake, right? It doesn't bite because it is not conditioned to bite and doesn't have the fangs to bite or the venom. So even if the garter snake got really angry at you, it still couldn't strike you and do any harm. It's not what it's about, is it? Okay. So understanding that, you interact with that snake as it is. Now, if you encountered a rattlesnake, right, you would. And you understood that's what it was, you would respond to it, react to it very differently, wouldn't you? You might, if you have choices, not approach it, right? Give it a wide berth, right? On the other hand, if circumstances brought you to having to interact with it, right? You would make sure that you're wearing protective clothing, right? And we're careful, right? Because you understood what you were dealing with. You don't hate the snake. You don't hate the rattlesnake, do you? It is the product of its causes and conditions, right? And it, you know, I don't know if in the rattlesnake universe there are rattlesnake Gandhis, you know, who are going around, communicating to other rattlesnakes, talking to them about, we should really stop, attacking people and put away our fangs and, you know, maybe we should just, you know what I'm saying? I don't think rattlesnakes have that capacity. to change.
I was thinking more in terms of Little Red Riding Hood with mm-hmm. the wolf dressed up in sheep's yeah. clothing.
Well, that's the same thing. Again, you know, when it began, you know, in the beginning, Little Red Riding Hood didn't have a lot of discriminating understanding. Hi, Grandma. Right? It's me, Little Red Riding Hood. Right? She was just like very, you know, conditioned. But then she began to look a little more deeply. Remember? Practicing. She stopped. Samatha. And Vipassana, she looked deeply. And what did she begin to notice? Well, it was a little slower than that, you know, sort of like big ears. You know, what's that? No, you know what I mean? It was like that, and finally got to the teeth. Right. So again, and I think that is that's a meaningful, because sometimes it doesn't appear. Right. I mean, a rattlesnake is kind of maybe, you know, it's got that rattle. So it's a good warning. Sometimes we see a snake in the garden and we don't know what it is right away, do we? And sometimes we encounter a human being, and like you say, they, you know, they outwardly go, oh, yes, yeah, I'll do that, or yeah, you know. But then as you watch them, you notice what? They got teeth. They are not your grandmother. Even though they're dressed in your grandma's clothes. Again, it is the mind, right? In this Saha world, in this human world, right? We all sort of look the same, don't we? I mean, we have different shapes and colors, but, I mean, basically our definition of being fellow human beings is we more or less, you know, are mammals. We have two arms, two legs, we have a face, you know, and it's kind of all put together in kind of the same way, right? So outwardly, we more or less can identify human beings by the way they look, right? But you shouldn't be fooled, because the actions of body, speech, and mind are conditioned by the mind, right? And the minds of human beings are very different. In Buddhism, there are, you know, different minds. Some people have hellish minds, great suffering minds. Right? Violet minds. Some people have minds of just great fear and great yearning and desire and dissatisfaction. Some people have minds that are very dumb. They just don't, they're just not capable of insight. They're only driven by impulse. There's no check on their impulsivity, right? Some people, minds, you go inside their minds, they're only concerned with power, control, getting what they want, getting power over, right? Some people who are only concerned with sensuality and luxury and looking beautiful and looking good and having, you know what I mean? And that's, so, you know, we all inhabit the same realm. We all inhabit the same form, but minds are very different. And I think that's what you're, you know, and at some point in Buddhism, again, it's that's just the way it is. Right? And again, you know, most of us are combinations thereof. Right? More or less within ourselves. You know, if you look at a painting of the Wheel of Life, which enunciates these six, we could say them psychological, or if you want to think geographical realms. In the center of it is greed, anger, and ignorance. It's kind of the axle. around, which sees six wheels roam. And since we're talking about Dharma, in the center of this wheel, in which it shows human beings are just kind of, you know, going around these six different mind states. Sometimes they're in this one, and sometimes they're in that one, and, you know, they're just kind of going around. There's usually in the paintings a monk, and he's pointing. And he's pointing off the wheel. And there's like a little path that he's kind of pointing us to. And up there is sitting the Buddha. Right? So it's saying, if you're looking for a meaning, a satisfaction, happiness, you're not going to find it in this world that is driven by greed, anger, ignorance, delusion, egocentricity. It's just not here. You're just going to be always going up and down. I mean, you're always going to be the rat chasing the cheese.
Wanted you to take Alex's question one step further, and aside from giving the rattlesnake the wide berth, when you're in a confined space and you can't give the rattlesnake the wide berth, then what do you do?
Well, the question is, just pushing the rattlesnake analogy a little further, what happens if you're in a confined space with that rattlesnake and there's it's just you with a rattlesnake? You know, it's interesting. I think at that point, when your life is being directly threatened, one has the option of protecting oneself, which could be at that level. If one has no other alternative, taking the life of. And that we know we make those choices, don't we, in society. I mean, it could be, if you so fit and you have totally made a commitment never to take life, that you let the rattlesnake do what it does. But I think for most of us at that point, we'd make the choice to... if we can't capture the real estate, the rattlesnake... may have to kill it. And I think that's, sometimes in life, if someone is threatening people, if they can't be stunned or whatever, often to protect it for the greater good, a life has to be taken. I mean, even Dalai Lama has acknowledged the right of a country or people to, if they need to protect themselves. To take up arms as a last resort, right? Unfortunately, we live in a world where it seems we take up as a first resort and not a last resort. So I think, that capacity is there. I mean, sometimes, right, for the greater good or the protection of the greater good, we have to isolate those who cannot help themselves from doing harm. That's why we put children in time out, too. Send them to their room. Yes.
I was just going to say, in a response to somebody suffering, and you could see they're suffering because of outside things, and to respond by saying, these are only material things. We can let go of them, and to respond like that because they're suffering because they have to let go of it. That doesn't bring great joy.
Yeah. I mean, and then that's again,
it doesn't people don't appreciate.
Right. You just make their suffering worse. Yeah, I get. So the question is, I think she's going. Like going back to the Buddha and Ananda, if some of the people I know were grieving
And I came in and started talking about, you know, all composite things dissolve and, you know, this and this. I might not have a good reception. And you're absolutely right. You know, the Buddha was talking to who? Ananda, his student, his disciple, and someone who he knew, you know, was doing his best sincerely to be a practitioner. And the Buddha was just reminding him. It was a teaching moment, we could say, right? And these moments of extremities, if we are open, are all teaching moments, because we see, left to our own devices, we will go down our traditional pathways. And all of a sudden, a teacher or a fellow practitioner kind of holding up that Dharma mirror and reminding us, oh, this is normal, right? Or like you're saying, you know, if you chase after material things, it doesn't always work out the way you want. And if there's gain, there's a very good chance that there could be loss, and that this is the way of the world. Now again, somebody who you know is open to that, that could be helpful. But somebody who's not, it could just get them angry, you know, like make yourself righteous, or you know what I mean, or don't preach to me, you know, or just make them feel worse or something. So again, I think, you know, skillful and appropriateness is always the key in any kind of helping situation. Yeah. Sometimes, again, that's why in our tradition of deep listening, that's the first thing we do. We don't immediately give counsel. Right? We listen deeply to the person. We offer them our presence, right? And that may be all we can do, is to acknowledge, you know, in terms of this person, you know, who's going, who went after some kind of materialistic goal and now has lost it. And their suffering, just to simply acknowledge their suffering.
For how long?
For how long? Well, that's a...
I mean, you can...
Again, you're human beings. I mean, you know, I think, you know, there are different ways to help people. They may not be ready for the teachings, but they may be ready to hear, hey, I think it's time to get over this one. You know, I mean, they may not be ready to learn anything. But you may say, maybe it's time to accept that this has happened and, you know, let's move on. You know what I'm saying? Which is, I think, a more practical, non-judgmental kind of... And it, I mean, something like that may be helpful to somebody, just to say, you know, I think this has been, you know, going around long enough and, you know, I'm getting sick of hearing it and I'm sure... you know, the suffering that you're experiencing, you know, and maybe it's time just to, you know, accept that this is what's happened and come up with some solutions, and I'm here for you for that. And, you know, without getting into the bigger picture of, you know, how they've caused their own suffering. And most people don't want to hear that, do they? I mean, that's what we're talking about. I mean, insight, you know, in terms of Alex's bell curve, I mean, there's a bell curve. And most people are not looking deeply, don't want to look deeply, or may not even have the capability at this stage of their own development to look deeply. And so for us to kind of put that way to someone who is not ready, you know, that's our foolishness or our ignorance or our really lack of compassion, because we're not seeing them as they are and accepting them as they are. You know, we want them to be different. We want them to see how they're creating suffering for themselves. But we know, I mean, the basic teaching of Dharma is that, you know, fundamentally, most of people's emotional suffering is self-created. I mean, that's kind of a given. I mean, how many people are actually, you know, I mean, this is not a gathering of 36 million people here, is it? So just a few things about
I'm reading from this book for those of you who were in the intensive several years ago on the Shanti Deva's Bodhicaratara. This is the Nectar of Manjusri speech, that commentary on the Bodhicaratara, The Way of the Bodhisattva by Kunzang Peldon. And he says, in accordance with the formula, the Buddha is the teacher unsurpassed, the sacred Dharma is the guardian unsurpassed, the Sangha is the leader unsurpassed, the actual protector or refuge for beginners, and we're all beginners, is in fact the Dharma. Somebody was asking yesterday about why just the Dharma as the refuge. The Buddha said, I have taught you the methods that lead to liberation. Practice with diligence. Your liberation depends on you. The Buddha also said, the sage does not, a sage referring to the Buddha, the sage does not wash sins away with water, nor wipe away the pain of beings with his hands. His realization he does not transfer to others. He frees by showing them the peace of ultimate reality. And then Kunzang Peldon comments, this means that deliverance from the sufferings of samsara and the lower realms comes from accomplishing the sublime dharma. Therefore, the true refuge for beginners is the sacred dharma. The other two jewels, which is the Buddha and the Sangha, are in themselves unable to give such protections. And this is why the sacred Dharma is described as the unsurpassable refuge or protection. Right? So the Buddha, the teachers, can show us the way. They can be examples for us. They can mentor us. They can guide us. But the Buddha says, I cannot wash away your sins, right? Lindsay was asking, right? How do you do that stuff from the past? That still darkens our minds. And all we can say is, this is how you do it, right? This is how you heal. This is how you transform your suffering, but you have to do it. He cannot transfer his realization. He's incapable of transferring his realization. All he can do is show us the peace of ultimate reality, but he cannot put us there, right? So that is why Kunzang Peldon is saying you can't count on the Buddha for that, for your liberation, as well as the community of practitioners, right? Let's say us, or the monastics, nuns, or whatever, the fourfold Sangha. Again, they can be our elder brothers and sisters, they can support us, they can guide us, they can offer us friendship, all that, but still, what? They cannot transform our minds, right? They cannot bring us to the level of deliverance and liberation. So it's for that reason of the three gems, he is saying here, it is the Dharma that really offers us, in this case he says protection. It's an interesting thing. Protection from what? From the sufferings of the world, right? You know, sometimes parents, they come to that place where they realize they cannot protect their children from the sufferings of the world, right? I can't do it. You can't do it, can you, Martina?
Yeah.
No, you can't do it. Mothers and fathers in the room, uncles and aunts, you can't do it. No matter how hard you try. Ultimately, what? The children have to find their way and learn to protect themselves. So that why we know as parents, as mentors, our job is not to create bubbles around them to keep them safe. Our job is to give them the tools so they can keep themselves safe, right? So it's like that for us.
It is the tools of Dharma, the teachings of Dharma, the understandings of Dharma that have the power to truly protect us from suffering and to facilitate our capacity to live a liberated, free life. So that is why we see in these teachings we've been working on, the Buddha says, after he says, be an island, you know, he puts it on us. Be an island unto yourself, be a refuge unto yourself. But then he says, you know, that which in you that you're taking refuge, it is the Dharma. Right? The Dharma is your refuge. The Dharma is your island. Because he knew that he would. This is the end of his... It's interesting that all these teachings all come from the same period in the Buddha's life. Whether, I'm not sure, the last couple of years or last 6 months, but we see he was very clear. Right? He had spent a life as a Buddha teaching. He had created a fourfold community of monks and nuns and laymen and lay people that was well established, and now he was saying, but your refuge has to be yourself and yourself as Dharma. You, each of you, has to become the living Dharma, manifest the Dharma in your life. So again, I think that's very poignant. Given that the true refuge is the Dharma, what is the point, one may ask, of describing the Buddha and the Sangha also as objects of refuge? Because the fact is, if there had been no Buddha, we'd still be in ignorance and would have no inkling of what we call Dharma. Because he perfectly revealed to beings a faultless path that he himself had traversed, the Buddha is an object of refuge. As for the Sangha, the truth is that we, the inhabitants of a decadent age, have not been fortunate enough to meet the Buddha in person. Nevertheless, the Sangha guides us on the authentic path of liberation. And therefore, the Sangha, too, is an object of refuge. For those of you who go, well, then can't I just take one refuge? He's saying, even though the Dharma is the primary refuge. Now, of course, you know, now we have Thich Nhat Hanh in 2010, he's going, the Sangha is the primary refuge. And again, this is all subject to interpretation, but it's interesting. We can see, therefore, that we need to take refuge in the three jewels as our teacher, path, and companions. This is a point of vital importance. And one last thing I wanted to share with you before we end. And then tomorrow I will share with you some teachings from the sixth patriarch in Zen, what he calls the formless refuge. This is from a living Buddha of our age, a man called Dzogchen Rinpoche, who passed away in the 80s. I think a number of years ago, at one of our Southern Dharma retreat, I taught his instructions on doing a great Dzogchen, great perfection retreat, wonderful teachings. It's a little dense, but I thought it was... It was a little paragraph about refuge, and then we'll end. I'm sort of overwhelming you with Dharma today. Please just relax and let it rain in. Let it rain in on your parade. He says, because we exist in duality, we experience delusory. I mean, I could really give a whole Dharma talk on this, but let me just read it and see what you make of it. It's a little dense and profound, but these are the way these guys talk.
I mean, they're really, they just talk this way spontaneously. I mean, it's, this is actually a talk. He says, because we exist in duality, we experience delusory dissatisfaction. Just go with this. Because of this, we take refuge in order to be freed from the experience of self-generated dissatisfaction. Due to misapprehending our true nature, and then in parentheses, because of the delusory appearances that arise when the various elements coalesce in accordance with patterns of dualistic confusion, close parentheses, this human body becomes the container of endless dualistic projections. It becomes a source of attachment in terms of supplying delusory definitions of existence. This attachment remains very strong until you see the true nature of existence, until you are completely freed from the delusion that your body validates your existence. Dissatisfaction will continually color your experience. Because of this, the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, exist as a focus of refuge. Need I say more? No, I didn't think so. If you want, we could maybe talk about this a little tomorrow. It's a very profound and pregnant with meaning little paragraph. But it, again, bottom line is what? Because of this, we need to take refuge.